It's New Books in Psychoanalysis. I'm Richard Briette. I'll be your host for this episode. And today I'm honored to be speaking with Dr. Vamik Volkan. Dr. Volkan is Emeritus Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Virginia, Charlottesville, the Senior Eric Erickson Scholar at the Erickson Institute at the of the Austin Riggs Center, Emeritus Training and Supervising Analyst at the Washington, D.C. Psychoanalytic Institute. Dr. Volkan was born on the island of Cyprus to Cypriot Turkish parents. I should warn New Books listeners, I'm reading a long bio here of Dr. Volkan. I thought it would be important to really share the list of his accomplishments because I see it as part of the interview. In 1987, Dr. Volkan established the Center for the Study of Mind and Human Interaction at the University of Virginia School of Medicine. That center applied a growing theoretical and field-proven base of knowledge to issues such as ethnic tension, racism, large group identity, terrorism, societal trauma, mourning, transgenerational transmissions, leader-follower relationships, and other aspects of national and international conflict. He was a member of the International Negotiation Network under the directorship of the former President Jimmy Carter from 1989 to 2000, and also a member of the Working Group on Terror and Terrorism of the International Psychoanalytic Association. Dr. Volkan had the honor to give the keynote address in Cape Town, South Africa, in 2006, celebrating Archbishop Desmond Tutu's life of peaceful justice and the 10th anniversary of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's activities. He also felt honored to have been nominated three times for the Nobel Prize, Peace Prize, including the 2017 nomination. At the present time, Dr. Volkan is also president of the International Dialogue Initiative, a nonprofit organization that brings together unofficial representatives from various parts of the world, such as Germany, Iran, Israel, Russia, Turkey, the UK, the USA, and the West Bank, to examine world affairs from a psychopolitical angle. The IDI develops a common language between psychoanalysts and those who are diplomats, politicians, or from other disciplines. Also, in a very exciting bit of news, Dr. Volkan received the Sigourney Award for 2015, and we're going to talk about that a little later. Dr. Volkan, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So what we're going to be talking about today, I suppose I should mention the book. The book is called A Nazi Legacy: Depositing Transgenerational Transmission, Dissociation, and Remembering Through Action, and that's 2015 Karnak. Dr. Volkan, could you tell us about the book and how you came to write it?
Well, I have been involved in German affairs, so to speak, since the reunification of Germany, because I was interested to know how the reunification would increase prejudice against the guest workers and foreigners. And this was happening because East Germans perceived West Germans as the descendants of the Nazis and vice versa. And when they got together, they had to project this kind of feeling to somebody else. And because of that, I've been supervising a lot of psychoanalysts in Germany, and I noted that sometimes they were having difficulty discussing the Holocaust-related issues with their patients. And then this patient came along. This is the grandson of a very famous Nazi. We are not going to mention his name. And we were able to see how transgenerational transmissions also occur among people who are not the victims but perpetrators. And this has been a very difficult area for them to talk about it or write about it. And so I decided to write this book.
And that's, when I hear the words transgenerational transmission, I automatically in my mind follow that with the word trauma. And I think we're going to get into, I definitely want to get into how transgenerational transmission, say, from descendants of survivors versus perpetrators. I want to ask you about that, and I'm glad that you mentioned that aspect. But I want to, before, to kind of set some context for this, I wanted to ask you about your own formative experiences that got you interested or motivated you to do the work about prejudice and ethnic tension and violence. Can you talk about your background from Cyprus?
Well, I'm from the island of Cyprus, and when I was growing up, the island was a British colony. And I don't know if you know this island, it's a beautiful place. And there are Turks and Greeks, and including smaller minorities, Armenians, even Phoenicians, historical Phoenicians. They have two or three villages in Cyprus. And, you know, as the world changed, the British left the island, and the island became independent. But since they had different ethnic groups there, blood started running. It was horrible. So I came to this country in 1957, and 3 months later, my roommate in Ankara, I was attending the medical school in Ankara, Turkey, and I had a roommate. He was like my brother. He went back to Cyprus to visit his ailing mother, and a Greek terrorist shot him while he was buying medicine for his mother in a pharmacy. And you can imagine, I was in a new country in Chicago. I did not know anybody else. And I got this news, and I couldn't mourn because I didn't know anybody. Who would I talk to about these things? So when I became a psychiatrist, I suddenly realized, I mean, I didn't realize for a long time, I began writing books on mourning, and when I had opportunity to get involved in world affairs, I began to work on bringing people to a table to make peace, and they all had to do with my background, of course.
You know, there's a when you talk about this story in the book A Nazi Legacy, and there was a very poignant detail for me as I read it. You mentioned that your medical school friend, who you felt like was your brother, you mentioned that he was shot 7 times, and I just found it very poignant that you remembered the number of times, and you pointed that out. Now you say that at the time you got the news, you didn't have anyone to talk about, talk to about it. But I think what you say in the book, and the irony here, is that you were in analysis at the time, no?
No. This happened in 1957. I did not begin my analysis until I finished my internship at residency and came to university.
Okay.
So at least after 5 years, I went into analysis.
Got it. However, you do point out in the book that it's not something that you talked about in the analysis.
That's correct, because it goes back all the way to Freud.
Right.
In 2006, I was Freud professor in Austria, and my office was at Freud's home. 19 Bergasse Strasse. And I spent 4 months in Freud's house, so to speak. And I didn't have much to do, so I kept thinking about who was this guy? What was he doing here? You know, I was touching the, you know, walls and so on that he had touched. And I figured out that he knew when he left Vienna, he would be, you know, his sister and neighbors would be killed and so on. And he was a discoverer. He discovered the internal world. And this is why he did not want to touch external things. You know, remember there's a dialogue between him and Albert Einstein.
Right.
Albert Einstein asked him, you know, what can we do about wars, about world affairs? And he said, oh, no, let's don't touch it. So this tradition stayed with classical psychoanalysis, especially ego psychoanalysis in the United States. And my analyst was wonderful, but he was a classical analyst. So external events never would come to the office, so to speak, not talk about it. Everybody
right.
was interested in internal issues. And that's why I think that my analyst and I, we did not discuss much what was happening in Cyprus and my feelings about this or that.
I don't know that this question occurred to me, but I it made me wonder, were you the analyst in that position? Would you have talked about it?
Now, not only I, but many people mm-hmm. are talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
There's another reason for this, because most of the famous analysts were related to Holocaust, a lot of Jewish origin famous analysts. And my hunch is that they did not also want to open up this painful topic. There are some papers about this.
Right.
I know some friends, very good friends, who were, descendants, or they escaped from the Holocaust. They did not talk about it until they were in their 70s.
Right.
Things are changing now, especially after September 11th. Other psychological branches are paying attention to external world, and this forced psychoanalysts also to pay attention to it.
I would say that if anything, you're advocating for people to pay attention, for psychoanalysts to pay attention.
Yes, because it is there is always an intertwining of external world and internal world. And if we do not take that into consideration, I don't think that we can do full analysis of certain people.
Right.
Because there are certain people in their lives, external traumas are so important. They change their internal world. So we need to understand how this intertwining takes place.
All right. Well, that certainly is a segue to talk about the case.
Yes.
Before we get the patient's name in the case, the name that you give him is Victor.
Yes.
Before we get to him, I want to ask you to give us a brief definition of transgenerational transmission so that we're all sort of on the same page about it.
Okay. Interestingly enough, after I got involved in international relations, I knew the importance of transgenerational transmission not from the patients, but from diplomats and others who were discussing with enemy representatives.
Huh.
For example, when you brought Russians after the Soviet Union collapsed, when we brought Russian big shots from Duma, secondary in Duma, et cetera, and a bunch of Estonian parliamentarians and so on and so on. During discussions, if the Russians felt humiliated, they would start talking about the Mongol invasion of Russia centuries ago.
Right.
And suddenly I realized that when massive traumas occur, the images of these traumas go through generation to generation. And this issue then becomes very interesting. There's a change of function instead of remembering actual trauma, because after so many years or centuries, you're not part of the trauma. What you remember is that this trauma only occurred to your group. And therefore, it is a marker for your group.
Right.
If you're Russian, you are the only one who had the Mongol invasion. If you are Serbian, you only group on earth who had the Battle of Kosovo, for example. And this observation made me to start paying attention to individuals on the couch. And I suddenly, I had a patient whose family goes back to Robert Lee, so to speak. And I could see relationship of that time going from generation to generation and giving him direction to develop this or that kind of structure, internal structure. This book that we are talking about is fantastic in exploring this concept. The grandfather was a key person in the evolution of euthanasia program in Nazi Germany. You know, putting kids, disabled kids, and later on others in a bus and gassing them. Can you imagine?
Yeah, and that I wasn't familiar with it, actually, until you write about it in the book.
Well, before the final solution for Jewish people, the mass murdering took place in this program. This program started before they began killing Jewish people directly.
So this was a program the Nazis started that was nicknamed T4.
T4, because I forgot the
street.
Name. Yeah, street name. And, you know, Hitler started it, and thousands and thousands people died, and then it became, you know, the method to kill also Jewish people and others.
It was a state run euthanasia program where the state decides that people with disabilities, mental and physical, should be eliminated, and even without the knowledge of their families. Just
and,
breathtaking
and
when
began,
I was reading it.
They began picking up people and calling them, you know, and then killing them in that fashion. And they were injecting, you know, poison, and that was expensive. So they came up, this grandfather and some other people. I'm not going to name his name because we don't want to hurt the patient. But they came up with the idea of killing people in buses. So coming back to transgenerational transmission.
Now, you mentioned You mentioned the idea of, you use a term for this in your book, chosen trauma and an entitlement ideology. And I think that's what you're saying with, you know, when someone's pride is hurt, they go back in time to a prior traumatic event, which becomes a chosen trauma. Is that right?
Yes. Well, I mean, chosen traumas, I'm talking about more societal way of remembering.
Okay.
This trauma only occurred to us. And when time comes, new leaders come and they re-inflame traumas from 600 years ago. The best example, again, comes from Milosevic. Milosevic, when he came to power, inflamed Serbian chosen trauma called the Battle of Kosovo, which had taken place in, my God,
1200s?
600 years ago.
Yeah.
And they built their monuments, they dug out the body of the Serbian leader during this battle. My God, whatever was left. Few bones, I don't know what was left. They put in a coffin, they went from village to village. Every night they buried the bones, they reincarnated them. They induced all kind of emotions, and people say, okay, we are Serbians, we are victims, therefore we are entitled to do this or that. I don't mean only Serbians do this, by the way. I don't want to talk against Serbians. Everybody in the whole world are the same, by the way, for me, because I have been to so many countries. We are all human.
Well, your description of what they're doing with the body, it certainly calls to mind Freud and Moses and monotheism and the period he was writing that during the rise of the Nazis.
Yes. But in individual case, like this German guy comes to analysis, and he has a peculiar symptom. In the middle of the night, he wakes up, and he doesn't know. He's in a dissociated state. He goes and tries to break windows, and he screams, there's danger, let's get out of here. And he doesn't remember this himself. his girlfriends, because he's now grown up, he has girlfriends. The girlfriends say to him, hey, you woke up in the middle of the night and you tried to break windows. You wanted some air. You wanted this or that, and there's some danger. Only thing he remembers is that his heart was beating faster.
Right.
And so of course, nobody, no girl wants to stay with him, so they leave him. But then he found a new girl whom they were married later on, but he had done something for this girl's family financially, so the girl stayed with him, but he had to come to analysis to figure out why was this happening. Okay. The German analyst finds certain reasons, like any analyst would find from events from childhood. That is, he had two surgeries, and he was gassed, okay? And so he might remember, the trauma during surgeries, and he was gassed. But he had no idea that his grandfather was one of the important people of the euthanasia program. This kind of, the parents knew, and they, what I call technically, deposited image of grandfather in him, because parents did not want to have such a person in their family. They wanted to get away from guilt feelings, and they gave him a task to repeat grandfather's, bad business, but reverse it, break the windows and bring oxygen into the bus.
Right.
So that nobody would die. And here we see, without knowing the history, we could not, the German analyst lady could not analyze this man.
So just to be clear, for some context for the audience, this is a woman, I don't know if it's her real name. You call her Dr. Adeline?
No, not her real name.
Okay.
No.
Yeah, in the book you call her Dr. Adeline, and she contacts you for supervision.
Yes.
For this case of this young man that comes to her for treatment, complaining about this bizarre night behavior.
Yes.
And so just in case, it was a subtle connection, but he recalls a terror of being gassed as a child for these surgeries. I think one was at age 3 and then 3.5 and then later in his adolescence.
Yes, but he connected this also without knowing,
right,
with his grandfather's actions. So here was intertwining of his personal stories with what was passed to him historically.
Right.
Yes.
So since we're getting into talking about the case,
yes.
Just again, for reference for the audience, what you do with your book, and the book is 100 pages. It's actually 99 pages long, and it's incredible. I have not taken more notes for an interview than I have on this book. You have a couple of chapters on theory, the chapter on your background and your thoughts about the need for psychoanalysts to be more aware of their own silence and their own potential for enactment with transgenerational transmission. But then those chapters are interspersed with the case study. It's, it on the outside, it looks like, a case study, but it is so much more. So we follow the whole treatment from your position as you're supervising it. And I believe Dr. Adeline requested that you write it up. Is that right?
She, it took her 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Because she told me later on, of course, I could not write everything about her.
Right.
She also had a Nazi father.
Right. Which is a key piece of this story.
And also I learned much later that this patient had come to see her soon after her father had died.
Mm.
So both of them denied the fact that the patient patient behavior was very much connected with transgenerational transmission.
Right.
And it took them 3 years to realize this.
Right.
And then everything opened up.
And her father, the analyst's father, was in Hitler Youth and then later joined the army, the Nazi army.
Yes.
So there, you know,
I cannot say much about him because, again, I want to protect the.
Of course.
Yes.
So shall we talk about Victor and get more into detail on the case?
Yes, of course.
Okay. I know that. Well, let me ask one question about a little bit about theory.
Sure.
And we're talking about depositing.
Yes.
In other words, I know that Victor's parents were aware of, obviously aware of the grandfather's activities. He was in the, you know, he was a high level official. And they had the grandfather's letters, which they edited, I think, or they hid some of them probably. And so they were very aware of his activities. And the idea is they sort of willfully repressed the knowledge of the grandfather's criminal, I guess we could say criminal, I don't know, perpetrator activities. But then the theory is that that repressed, let's say, I don't know, object is essentially deposited via the unconscious into the grandson, into Victor.
Yes.
Now, is that an example of transgenerational transmission via a perpetrator? And is that different from...
No, I mean,
okay.
I think the best way to explain to the listener...
Yes.
Because psychoanalysts and other psychologists and psychiatrists knew about depositing a long time ago, but we did not pay attention to it. And that comes from so-called replacement children.
Uh-huh.
There
right.
is a mother has a child, the child dies, mother
right.
gets pregnant, has another child, and name the second child after the first child. That doesn't mean that anything bad is going to happen because of that.
Right.
But if the mother has an image of the dead child, new
right.
child has no image, no experience with the dead child. But mother treats the second child as if the second child is a reincarnation of the first child.
Right.
In a sense, an image that belongs only to mother is given by mother to the child. In identification, in interaction with the other, the child is active, taking things in and becoming like mother or imitating and taking in and identifying with father, teachers, and so on. In depositing, it's like identification, but the active person is the adult. Adult has certain things. Child has no idea about them. Adult pushes those things into the child's developing self-representation.
Right.
Okay? And this is what happened also with this case. If you look at the story, you know, when they had children, they were very, very afraid that one of them would be, handicapped.
The parents had two children.
Yes.
Victor is the oldest, and he has a younger brother, Richard.
Yes, and especially younger brother, Richard, they perceived him as a handicapped person. And then they said to Richard, you be the savior. And supposedly Richard one time in his childhood saved the family from fire, you know. So they created both the victim and the victimizer and the savior and omnipotence, everything. And they locked up all these letters and so on. And so...
Can I... do you mind if I quote you?
Yes, please.
Okay. Because you make this point about how the depositing works.
Yes.
And you say... If what is deposited into the child's developing self-representation is a grand image, it may function as an initiator for a future grandiose self.
Yes.
And I think for that...
that itself also becomes, you know, it can be normal or it can be exaggerated.
Okay. Yeah. But we're also, I saw that as really explaining the narcissistic personality presentation that he came to treatment with.
Oh, of course. In his case, obviously.
Yes.
And that was confusing. See, he knew it, but only symbolically.
Right.
He had a daydream, or he talked about carrying an egg under his arm.
Right.
And this egg was filled with chaos. And he was afraid that this egg would crack and things would come out, chaos would come out. And he had no idea what chaos was. And as you know, as analysis goes on, then he understands that it is the deposited image of grandfather, but also not only that he's going to do things and so that they will not feel guilty, how he would save people from being gassed, but he also, as you suggested, took the grandiosity of his grandfather.
Right.
Again, there are certain things that I could not write in the book because we needed to protect his image. But part of it is written in the book. He ends up finding grandfather's you know, where he lived, and he doesn't have money, but he spent all his money to buy that place and live there. I mean, he also had grandiosity, unbelievable grandiosity, and the chaos was, same time he wanted to be a savior.
Right.
Yeah.
And would I be wrong in saying that this is really a case study of, you know, working with a narcissistic character?
Yes, well, narcissistic characters, they have different reasons mm-hmm. for becoming narcissists.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons, I have this another book that describes the different family backgrounds of narcissistic people. In this case, you were quite right. The narcissism was what was deposited in him.
Right.
He was going to be number one. Big shot, but same time number one savior of family name, and also reversing the guilt feelings and so on.
You know, the egg image that you mentioned.
Yeah.
It was described in the book as a kind of daydream that he had, but
yeah.
After you mentioned something that I thought was, you know. If you've worked with, a narcissistic patient, this is particularly sort of poignant, but also funny. After a year of treatment, Victor added an image to this daydream of walking with the egg. And you write, a small bird landed on his shoulder, and this made him feel nice. Apparently, the patient had no curiosity about the little bird.
Yeah.
But, you know, Dr. Adeline goes on to, you know, ponder or consider that the little bird is represents her, the analyst.
Well, also, you know, again, we could not write it very carefully, you know, because, again, to protect the innocent, mm-hmm. so to speak, the doctor's real name has something to do with that kind of thing.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So, okay.
But, got it. you know... If I may, I think that one of the sort of successful avenues that the treatment took was linking Victor's dissociated self with the grandiose self.
Yeah.
And, that was one of the particularly fascinating aspects of the case. And, you know, again, for the audience, I would say that the book has, you know, it's rich with very broad theoretical questions, but then it also gets down into the sort of granular technique questions of the case, which are just fascinating. And so that, I think, is part of what Dr. Adeline and you are able to do, is start to draw these bridges and links for Victor. And that's really one of the really impressive aspects of watching this treatment unfold.
Yes. And also, I mean, one of the areas that I discuss in the book, also the concept of action in psychoanalysis. And again, in classical psychoanalysis, if you remember something in action, that was called acting out.
Right.
And you would not pay attention to it, or you would not want patient to do it. You wanted patient to bring everything in words and discuss it in the room, etc. And there were people who noticed that some people cannot really get well until they repeat the story, including the transference aspect of it, in certain actions, in order to be sure that they can end the story in a different way in actual life. And we noticed that in my other work and so on, that in such actions, I call them therapeutic play.
Right.
And that...
Now, do you mean play as in playing in reality, or play as in Hamlet?
Yeah, I mean, you have to look at the whole psychoanalytic process as a play, a serious play.
Okay, because when you mentioned acting out, it naturally made me... one of the members of IPTAR, my institute, Gil Katz, has a book called The Play Within the Play, which is about enactment. And
yes.
I certainly thought a lot about that book while going over this book. So
yes.
I get it. Therapeutic play. Okay.
Yes. For example, this man invests his money to raise certain type of trees in order to increase oxygen.
For the world.
You see, that is, he has to go and actually does it. And he knows what he's doing, but without doing it, he cannot say, I am able to change what was in me previously. He has to go in action. There are many actions in the book that I refer how he gets involved in those things. You know, he goes to a part of town where butchers are,
right.
You know, butchering people, animals. I mean, they are, you know, Nazis and so on.
Right.
He notices the changes in this environment. He gets involved in this or that. This is how he changes. And this is also one theoretical aspect that this book very clearly illustrates, how if the analyst notices an action as a therapeutic play, we should not interfere with it.
Mm-hmm.
Just go along with it.
All right. So I don't want to brush over the initial. The point we're talking right now is later in the treatment. I think he's able to start making these links, and he's able to engage in this kind of play. But to give credit to you and Dr. Adeline, there are some tough years of work.
Well, some of the tough years also. I mean, I hint at the book that Dr. Adeline herself did not want to hear certain things.
Okay.
And so, but she developed, I think, a certain kind of transference, long distance transference with me, because she's in Germany, I'm in America.
Mm-hmm.
And that when time came, she would call me and kind of needed some encouragement to move on.
Right.
So this whole analysis, in fact, took, what, seven and a half years.
During which time she also, the treatment went down to once a week for a period of years.
Yes, that was making it, that's you know, that was a counter problem for her.
Mm-hmm.
And but she was very stubborn. Dr. Adeline was very stubborn, and she was also in her actual life very wanted to get rid of her own guilt feelings connected with the Holocaust and the family and so on. Very much so, very liberal person. And I think she also got a great deal for herself by analyzing this person.
Good. There's a point where you kind of have to shake things up or move things along. And I believe, without further ado, this gets us to the plate of enchiladas. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, oh my God, this is when I was in training. I learned that from my own.
You were at Austin Riggs, I believe?
No, I was not on Austin Riggs.
Okay.
I went to Austin Riggs after I retired.
Okay, yeah.
Old age. When I was trained in Washington, D.C. My psychoanalytic training was in Washington, D.C. I had good supervisors, Bill Granater, Harold Searles was my ideal.
He died a few days ago. Mm, right.
Bryce Boyer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bryce Boyer was in California, but he was kind of my mentor in those days. You know, whole psychoanalytic world was governed, so to speak, from New York. And there were a bunch of the analysts who were looking at external world issues and treating psychotic people and so on. And they were kind of pushed away. And somehow I got involved with them and learned a great deal from them.
Right.
How to treat people who are not just simply neurotic.
Right.
And the idea was that when some kind of stigmate occurs, not only because of the resistances, etc., on the part of the patient, but also counter responses on the part of the analyst.
Right.
And it just goes on like slowly repeating everything but going nowhere. And we learn even to say to the patient in analysis, hey, sit in front of me today, just for one day. I want to talk to you. And you kind of make a summary of analytic process and where you are.
This is what we've learned, etc.
And this is where we are, and this is our particular issue right now, and let's start all over again from this point on. And I came up with the word enchilada, and I think, I don't know if I wrote in the book.
You did.
At Austin Riggs and teaching, because Austin Riggs has patients, very, very difficult patients. They go, some people trying to commit suicide 10 times.
Mm-hmm.
Some people see 15 therapists before they come to Austin Riggs, and they are not typical neurotic people. So they are being treated there by experienced therapists, also by fellows under supervision. And in that situation, because they're staying at Austin Riggs for 3 months or 8 months or something like that, to make enchiladas, I found, was very useful, not only for the patient, but also for the young fellow.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was supervising Dr. Adeline, since I was not supervising her regularly every week, so to speak, there were situations in that her giving an enchilada to herself and to the patient was extremely useful.
Wait, did we explain where enchilada came from in the restaurant?
Yeah.
I think we better mention that. Yeah, and if you'll allow me, you were with some residents, I think, having lunch at a Mexican restaurant.
At Austin Riggs, yeah.
Yeah, uh-huh. And you were talking about this concept of presenting the work, and one of your colleagues said it's kind of like a plate of enchiladas with a lot of different options for ingredients.
Mexican food. Yes, exactly.
Okay. So the idea, you know, which is both funny, but also it struck me as incredibly practical, is you're essentially saying, okay, listen, this is what's going on.
Yes.
Here are the options. You're kind of shaking up the treatment.
Yes.
And inviting the patient to kind of join you in what? Making a decision about proceeding?
Well, you kind of make a, you are on the road and you took a different road and you got stuck there. And you making enchilada, the analyst doesn't say just one word or one sentence. Or
right.
One sentence. The analyst does explain the process it went through and where you are. So in a sense, you kind of make a new beginning with the patient. You agreement
right.
that you're going to work on this. Where you are.
Right.
Patient comes in and he or she is at the one point, but after 3 years or so and something, you are stuck in something, you are in different points. So that point has to be explained.
Right. So it's the enchilada technique. Dr. Volkan, we have a few minutes left.
Sure.
I of course, would have liked to talk about Victor in more detail, but I think we covered a lot of the major points.
Yes.
But there was one aspect of talking about silence, the silence of the analyst or the question about enactment.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a point when Victor started to make real lively connections between him, his yeah. grandiose and his dissociated self,
yeah.
where he sees a movie. And I'm guessing from the timing of the story that it was probably 12 Years a Slave. It was a movie. It was a movie about slavery
yes,
in the United
yes,
States.
Yes.
Okay. So,
yeah.
And I wrote down the bit because it was so, chilling to me that he says he recalled the film dealing with racism and thought he might be like the white people in the United States.
Yes.
And, you know, that gets to a question I have about where we are as analysts and what's happening in the world today, particularly, you know, in the United States right now. There's a lot of, I think racism is becoming much more seen in the public sphere and people are, it's becoming more obvious and more difficult to avert our eyes. And I can't help but be moved by this patient talking about becoming aware of his Nazi legacy and comparing himself to white people in the United States.
Yeah.
And this idea that talk about transgenerational transmission and slavery, and the history of slavery in the United States.
Yeah.
Can you speak to this and discuss the role that you see for psychoanalysts?
Yes, I think right now the world is changing so fast.
Yeah.
This is globalization, fast travel, especially communication technology. It changed everything. And now terrorism came into it. And we are in a confusion. The whole world, not only in America, but
mm-hmm.
everywhere I go, I see the confusion. Everybody's saying, who are we now?
Right.
That is, I call it the who are we now civilization.
Hmm.
I have no idea how we're going to settle. I'm not going to be able to say it. I'll be dead for a long time by the time it settles. And this brings up holding on our own kind, our own identity. And most of the time we go back. Very seldom after revolutions you are lucky and you have some leader that goes forward and brings things new and makes a different, wonderful world. Most of the time, like after Arab Spring, people go back.
I see.
You say, who are we now? You go back 100 years ago. Now ISIS is gone how many years ago, for God's sake. And this kind of thing also happened in America. We go back. When we say, who are we now? When we get scared, like what's happening today or yesterday, what happened in Paris, it's spreading all over and people saying, who are we now? And this brings up a lot of feelings about we are we and you are the other.
Right.
and that includes societal xenophobia, societal prejudice.
Right. All right. Well, I just want to ask you really quickly, what's next for you? Are you, do you have another book coming out? What are you working on?
Well, I write books, you know. I'm writing my 52nd book right now.
You're cranking books out. Yes, that's true.
I wrote this book, Nazi Legacy, as a, it's one of the series of books I wrote about psychoanalysis from beginning to the end.
Mm.
Because with pluralism in psychoanalysis, we need to say what we really do. And the only way that you can tell me what you do in your office, tell me a case from beginning to the end.
Mm-hmm.
And this is also important for new generation of psychoanalysts to read to see what happens. And so I wrote, I don't know how many, 5-6 books, and I wrote extra ones, not in English, because again, I wanted to protect the identity of patients. I wrote two in Finnish, and I wrote about, I don't know, 6 in Turkish, cases beginning to the end. And now, all this, who are we now, thing is happening, my new book that I'm working on, I'm working with a Finnish historian, writing about world affairs,
okay,
terrorism and so on. And now also I'm writing something about immigration.
Okay. Well, I'm sure it'll be none too soon that we look forward to those books arriving for us to read. It's been a real honor having you on the program. Dr. Vamik Volkan, the book is A Nazi Legacy, Depositing Transgenerational Transmission, Dissociation, and Remembering Through Action. Dr. Volkan, thank you so much.
Thank you for calling me.